Good afternoon. My name is Miriam Michaud, and I'm the director of the Center of Innovation for Economies and Conflict at the United States Institute of Peace. I will be moderating today's session, and I just had a few administrative points. Please remember to turn off your cell phones. We do have cameras in the back, so when we do take questions and answers, we'll do that along the side of the room. Our session here will go for about an hour and a half. The Executive Vice President of the Institute of Peace, Trish Thompson, will be introducing Mr. Lavin. So without further ado.
Thanks, Mary. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Institute of Peace. Again, I'm Trish Thompson. I'm the Executive Vice President. And Miriam asked me, before I turn it over to our keynote speaker, to give you a quick overview of the Institute that some of you may not be as familiar with the Institute as participants in many of our other conferences and panels. So the Institute is actually about 20 years old. It was established by the U.S. Congress as an independent, nonpartisan national institution whose mandate is to help increase the nation's capacity to manage conflict and to make peace. Our goals are actually, I think, quite simple, but also very powerful. They are to prevent violent conflict before it occurs, to help mediate and resolve it when the fighting is active, to promote post-conflict stability and development after the fighting ends. And in many ways, the most important goal of all, the Institute, is to develop intellectual capital, tools, methodologies, resources that we can use in zones of conflict and that we can share with others who are working to build and to make peace across the globe, again, in zones of conflict. We do a combination of work to that end. We do a lot of research, and for those in the private sector, what we call R&D. Again, developing the tools, the resources, the intellectual capital. We apply it in identifying best practices and identifying, you know, proven effective methodologies and things, again, that are practical and that can be used by practitioners on the ground. We then actually do use it ourselves in working in zones of conflict, as I mentioned, across the globe, from Iraq to Afghanistan to the Sudan, the Philippines, Colombia, and a number of other zones of conflict across the globe. Then we do something I think is particularly important. We turn it into resources that we can share with others and into training and education programs. So we take this full continuum of work that we do, and ultimately we convert it into training and education that we can share with others who can leverage what we know and what we've learned. How do we do this? Who does it? We basically have three different sets of active folks working on these issues. We have about 100 in-house staff of experts who have both subject matter expertise and regional expertise. We have, by law, 25% of our budget goes to investments in nonprofit organizations and academic institutions, NGOs. So 25% of our work is done in partnership with those communities. Every year we have 10 to 15 fellows who come to the Institute 4-year in residence who work with us on a variety of projects. And perhaps, again, most importantly, I think it's probably now over 50% of our projects are done in partnership with other organizations, from the State Department to USAID to the UN, OSCE, the African Union, USAID, and, again, a whole range of both governmental and non-governmental organizations with whom we partner. So there is progress in peace building out as you go out these doors in the back. I encourage you, if you haven't already grabbed a copy, to grab a copy to learn a little bit more about the Institute. And I will be here as well if you have any questions you'd like to ask me afterwards. Let me now turn it over to our keynote speaker. And I'm always impressed when I read these biographies. And this one is no different, quite an impressive background. Franklin L. Lavin serves as Undersecretary of Commerce for International Trade. And I find this is interesting, a role that has been called America's Salesman-in-Chief. As Undersecretary, he has been an advocate for American business and a steadfast promoter of free market across the globe. Since November of 2005, Undersecretary Lavin has led the International Trade Administration. This is comprised of 2,000 dedicated individuals posted around the world. The administration helps develop U.S. trade policy, identifies and resolves market access and compliance issues, administers U.S. trade law, and undertakes a range of trade promotion and trade advocacy efforts. Previously, he was the U.S. ambassador to the Republic of Singapore, where his duties included helping negotiate the landmark U.S.-Singapore Free Trade Agreement. From 1996 to 2001, he worked in Hong Kong and Singapore in senior positions at Citibank and Bank of America. His previous government service includes staff positions at the White House and the U.S. Department of State. He's earned a bachelor's degree from the School of Foreign Services at Georgetown. He's got a master's in Chinese language from Georgetown University, a master's in international relations and international economics from the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins, and an MBA in finance from the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, my alma mater, I might mention. So without further ado, let me turn over the podium to you, sir. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. And it might be, just if we're going to throw a few slides, it might be useful to talk from up here. I mean, whoever put that mic there, I think is with the camera, maybe we can shift that over here just so. Thanks. We put it up here if that's easier for you. Yeah, thanks. Thanks. Got it. Super. Thanks. Anyway, good. Well, we'll say thanks again. Thanks, Trish. Thanks, Miriam. Glad to be here. I'd had the chance to work with Dick Solomon in previous capacities in government, and he had very kindly invited me out. He said, you need to come to the Institute. And I'm glad to take myself up on the offer and see your headquarters and get a little more familiar with the work you're doing here. And I'm just sorry he's not here today to be part of it, but we'll catch up. Thank everybody for coming out. We've got an interesting topic, I think, to get into today because Iraq is typically perceived, not surprisingly, primarily, if not exclusively, through a security or a Powell Mill lens. And what I wanted to do today is try to shift that lens and talk about how to perceive Iraq through our area of responsibility, which is an economic commercial set of issues. So what I wanted to do was just discuss some of the things we're looking at in Iraq, understand Iraq a little bit better in relation to economic issues, talk more specifically about northern Iraq and the Gulf region, and share with you some of the insight we've shared with Iraq government leadership and, of course, some of our trips. To give you some background, the Commerce Department set up an Iraq task force the summer of 2003, so very early on in the political transition, and we have two core activities that we undertake in about every country in which we operate, 80-some countries worldwide. And there's a third core activity that I think is put into Iraq, which we've done in a few countries, but is not frequently part of our mandate. So the two core activities that takes place in every country, whether it's France or Rwanda or Japan, is that we work on promoting economic activity, promoting business activity, so transactional focus, and we also work on improving the business environment, doing whatever we can to improve the regulatory environment or the legal environment, whether it's tax law or any other element of government policies that inhibit business activity, to make it as easy as possible for businesses to be successful. And as I said, those two activities are somewhat universal. That's our sort of core statutory mandate at the Commerce Department. What we're doing in Iraq, in addition to those two core activities, is that we also are part of the PRT process, the Provincial Reconstruction Team process, meaning in addition to working with U.S. businesses on trade and investment, and in addition to working with the government leadership in Baghdad and elsewhere on policy and regulatory matters, we're also trying to work directly with the Iraqi business community and how can they expand and hire and find customers and make sure they have the inputs they need and the range of, you could say, everyday business issues. In a sense, a lot of what we do, you could say, is sort of everyday business issues, but of course in Iraq it all takes on a particular skew because of the security challenge and the other challenges in working that kind of environment. Let me talk first about our recent missions to Iraq. I had a chance to go last summer to Baghdad and then just a few weeks ago to Erbil, two different trips, and I'll talk about each of them. But the center of what we try to do is embodied in this PowerPoint, which was our presentation to government leadership in Iraq. I'm not going to go through the entire PowerPoint here, but we'll be happy to send it to you. It's about 20-some slides, and we could easily do a presentation and a discussion just on the policy elements or what we saw. But because I want to share some other material with you as well, I thought I'd give you an abbreviated version of some of the policy points, and then we'll talk about some of the other things we're doing in Iraq as well. So we took – go back one. Now go back two. Is that the first slide? Thank you. So as you can see from this, and this, by the way, so these are just slides taken right out of the presentation we gave to Iraqi government leadership. So what we tried to establish right up front is that we're just trying to do very straightforward analytical and promotional work about the nature of the Iraq economy and opportunities there for economic success. And as I was chatting with Trish earlier, I mean, there's a core political point here which doesn't even have to be articulated, which is you're not going to have a successful society unless you have a successful economy. So what can we do to help build out that successful economy? Go ahead. Thank you. The first point I think any discussion of Iraq has to reflect is the price that is paid by the security situation in Iraq. So as much as we want to get into the traditional business issues, it's important just to stop and take note of the economic price that is paid by security and how that tends to govern and constrain normal business decision making. Go ahead. Having said that, we also did some stock taking on what transition has taken place since 2003. I mean, there's been enormous emphasis on the political transition. Economically, the transition, I would say, has been somewhat attenuated. And if you go into the ministry setup that Saddam Hussein built up over the decades, the Ba'ath Party rule, and the degree to which state-owned enterprises directed economic activity in Iraq, you say that transition has partially taken place, but by no means completely. Well, there's been a lot of natural evolution in this with new companies registered, new stock exchange listings, SME activity, and in certain sectors, here we note the telephone and the internet, certain sectors have been in quite substantial progress. Go ahead. And by other economic indicators, there's been some reasonable results as well. Although I have to say, in all fairness, we know that this export number is up because the price of oil is up. So this really just reflects movement on the price of oil. Nonetheless, if you're on the Iraqi end, it represents good news. But I'll tell you something that is a little more meaningful to my mind is the currency stability. There's a fair amount of palm oil turmoil in Iraq, and to keep a stable currency and a stable exchange rate amidst that, I think it shows an impressive degree of central bank management. GDP has also moved up. Again, a lot of that is the oil price, GDP capita as well. But there are clearly other things going on beyond oil. Go ahead. And then the challenges. As I mentioned before, we see the bulk of the challenges being the legacy issues. That the state played a pervasive role in the economy, that there wasn't a normal commercial code that wasn't necessary in the Saddam Hussein regime. The banking system has a lot of limitations. Movement toward market rationalism is attenuated, and then that reflects itself sociologically on unemployment and underemployment. So we said, what does that suggest to us about priorities? And we come up with sort of a flip side of that, moving toward market incentives, trying to commercialize SOEs, which can be sensitive, but we've got to think that through. Reforming the PDS, which also can be sensitive, but we've got to think that through. By the way, the PDS is the public distribution system, is the national system for distributing food to everybody in Iraq. And it's not food stamps, and it's not food coupons, and it's not a check. It is physical delivery of food, of a basket of commodities, and it is universal. every single person in Iraq, regardless of need, on a monthly basis gets a physical delivery of a basket of commodities. So, and it absorbs about 10% of the GDP of the country. And it is by far the most extensive food subsidy program in the world. Enhancing the banking sector and housing construction. That land ownership, land title is an important element of economic modernization because for many people, think of people in the agricultural sector, it's their core asset. It's their their core family worth, and unless they can monetize that or sell part of it or buy something, they can't regularize their household finances. And then overlaid over all of that is corruption, which, again, attenuates government decision-making, puts a price on doing business. But we'll go back to the discussion. I want to just share with you. That was a presentation we gave to Iraqi government leadership. I mentioned a few weeks ago, about 6 weeks ago now, I was in Erbil, the capital of the Kurdistan region. And we just share with you a few photographs. So we just thought it was interesting to get a skyline of a half dozen construction cranes. There's an enormous amount of construction activity going on in Erbil. Erbil is a city of about 1 million people. Local statistics are hard to come by, but you'd say anecdotally economic growth is probably on the order of about 10% annually. So there is quite strong economic performance in Erbil. And from what we could see more broadly in the Kurdistan region, though we didn't get too far out of Erbil, it reflects, to my mind, or it suggests what could happen more broadly in Iraq if the security situation were in hand. And the security situation is very much in hand in the Kurdistan region. This is a retail outlet shopping mall, mixed facility, but largely retail outlet. I'm not sure how good the lighting is here, but you see it's a modern retail outlet, about a $1 billion facility going up in Erbil. Go ahead. And this is, we took a delegation looking through some shops in Erbil. This is, we went through a candy factory, confectionery factory, where this fellow has both a storefront and a little manufacturing facility. And but, you know, modern equipment, and he does catering and sells retail and sells wholesale and does gift boxes and sells to kids off the street as well. So it was interesting to go through the candy shop. And is that the last photo? That's great. It gives you a sense, I think, of some of the dynamism in Erbil. Let me touch on a few other elements of the trip. We went through the policy element. We had a chance to get around Erbil. We launched two initiatives in the course of our trip there. One was what's called the Northern Gateway Initiative, which is to say, if you're thinking about Iraq, if you're a U.S. company and you're trying to think about an Iraq strategy, think about the Kurdistan region as a possible gateway for Iraq because the security situation is in hand there. You do have broad latitude for business decision-making. It's easier to expand and build and hire and so forth, and it can be a reasonable platform for serving the rest of Iraq. So think about that. The second initiative we launched was the U.S.-Iraq Business Dialogue, which is a body composed of 10 Iraqi businessmen and 10 U.S. businessmen and businesswomen who meet among themselves to talk about the business operating environment and also report back up through the U.S. Department of Commerce and the Iraqi Ministry of Commerce as to what changes, what reforms could be made in the business environment. The point there is, look, in our view, anything that's good for Iraqi businesses is good for U.S. businesses and vice versa. Both business communities just seek a normal, efficient operating environment. So we should be happy to collaborate on articulating what deficiencies there might be in the system and how can they can best be addressed. We also, I mentioned one or two other points about Erbil. They have a $300 million new airport. It's an international airport. About five different international airlines have regularly scheduled flights in there. So they're very proud of what they've built out, and I think they should be. I had a chance a few weeks ago, just about 2 weeks ago, to visit the Gulf region, and it was also striking to me just to complement this Northern Gateway strategy. There's also a Southern Gateway strategy underway, meaning a lot of U.S. companies and other companies are looking at United Arab Emirates, principally Dubai, and Kuwait as platforms for business activity in Iraq. So whether they need to find a distributor or a joint venture partner or inventory their material offshore or manage offshore, we see a lot of international business activity in those two countries that's Iraq-oriented, specifically Kuwait, which is contiguous, of course, and has a long history dealing in Iraq. I think we have upwards of over 100 Kuwaiti companies that have operations in the southern area of Iraq. So just as when you go to northern Iraq, a lot of what you see might be, in effect, a Turkish transport company or Turkish bank or a Turkish product or an American product manufactured in Turkey distributed in northern Iraq, you're likely to see a Kuwaiti equivalent of that or a UAE equivalent of that in southern Iraq. And to my mind, that's all to the good. I think it's only to be expected that U.S. companies are going to prefer light footprint type of activities when they still have questions about the security situation. Let me sum up, and we can go to questions then. We left our discussions with the Iraqi government with three short-term goals. We articulated a set of policy goals, you saw, but then they said, what can be done in Iraq this year that would be helpful? We said we thought there were three core goals. One was overall investment legislation, and an investment bill is going through Parliament, has gone through, I should say, although implementing regulations have not yet been promulgated. So we said U.S. investors need to understand the investment environment before they're going to move. So that was the first core goal. The second core goal was hydrocarbon legislation. Similarly, there is a distinct set of legislation required for the oil industry as to who has mineral rights, what kind of royalty payment is there, who can negotiate, all the various technical aspects that have to do that if a U.S. oil major wants to participate in the economy, wants to invest or build a refinery, what kind of guarantees and protection do they have. That law has also been implemented but is not yet fully promulgated, though I get the feeling that we're at the finish line with it. It might be a matter of weeks, if not months, but that it's in effect. And the third point we made to Iraqi counterparts is please, in the course of this year, focus on at least one marquee transaction, one marquee investment, meaning you've got a sizable task in front of you. You've got to transition a large economy, and you've got to do this in a situation which is not propitious. So that's a huge task, and you can spend a lot of time on planning and blueprints and transition efforts, and it can take a long time to make happen. But one mechanism to start that process to get the virtuous cycle going is to get that marquee investment, meaning if one U.S. oil major comes in, if one U.S. major hotel chain comes in, if we get one name activity between one sell-off or partial sell-off of a state-owned enterprise, anything of that nature that we can point to, we're all going to be better off because that will be taken as a signal to market. So don't put all of your efforts focusing on the long-term plan. Put some of your efforts on a near-term transaction that will help drive other transactions. So that was our third request to counterparts in Iraq. Look, all in all, I let me just close with this thought. I left all of my discussions in Iraq and in Washington with a lot of admiration for Iraqi leadership. And these are people from various walks of life that are doing everything they can to help the society make a transition in very difficult circumstances. There's certainly a lot of bad news in the picture. There's also bits of good news in the picture as well. And I think we'll know in the course of this year, we'll have a better sense of how that shakes out. I could tell you on the economic side, as the security situation settles, I think there's enormous potential for all sorts of good news in the Iraq economy. We've got to come to terms with the security situation first. So that concludes my general remarks. I'd be very happy to take questions.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Chris.
We'll take questions, and it would be helpful if you could line up in front of the mics. And as moderator, I'm going to use my prerogative to ask you the first question, sir. What role does the U.S. Foreign Commercial Service play in our embassies that surround Iraq? What role do those officers play in promoting economic activity in Iraq? And the U.S. has Foreign and Commercial Service in Saudi Arabia, the UAE.
That's great, and people might not be aware, but Miriam used to work for the Department of Commerce. So sure there's life after commerce.
That's right,
it's a commerce. It's a commerce question.
Question.
No. We are focusing on, I use the term gateways. We're working on gateway cities outside of Iraq. So Dubai, Kuwait, Istanbul, and Ankara, I think, are the ones we view as, Istanbul, not Ankara, but Amman, Jordan, are the ones we view as gateway cities, which is a cities where U.S. multinationals will operate in and will tend to have regional management and work through Iraqi operations. In fact, one of our full-time people in Amman does nothing but Iraq-related activity. So we've got a full-time person in Amman to work on Iraq. For the other cities, what we look to do is on a regular basis, periodic basis, you can do it twice a year, is to have some kind of program or function or discussion with the American business community in these other cities. So that twice a year, there'll be a meeting of the Dubai AmCham or Dubai American Business Group, and there'll be a speaker in from Baghdad or somebody who can speak about the business operating environment. Just to keep them current, keep them understanding that as they're comfortable, as they see the market shifting, they have an ability to get active in those markets. So we have outreach to those other gateways.
Thank you, sir. Thanks. Sir, please introduce yourself first.
Hello? I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay. Chris Shea for CNO Resources. Thanks very much for taking the time to talk to us. Two things you said I intrigued me, and I was hoping you could fill out the picture on it a little bit better. One of them was the description of that every Iraqi household receives food every month. So what immediately comes to my mind on that is, based on that, there's these functioning distribution channels where trucks are able to drive to Iraqi homes every month. There's presumably big some sorts of big distribution warehouses. So that seems a very positive signal that the country's functioning very well if you're able to drive and reach every household every month.
There's mail delivery in Iraq. I mean, there's a high degree of functionality. There's also a fair amount of violence. But when you saw those GDP numbers go up, per capita GDP go up, there's an economy that's underway. By the way, let me give you one statistic. U.S. exports to Iraq last year, and this is not sales to U.S. government, this is not sales to U.S. contractors, this is not sales to multinational force, but U.S. sales into Iraq last year were about $1.5 billion. Something's working. I mean, there's got to be stores, there's got to be currency ability to handle, there's got to be distribution systems and warehouses. So there's an economy there. It's an economy under stress, but it functions.
Right. I mean, thanks for saying that. It really struck me because there are huge implications for that. I mean, I wonder to myself, obviously, so if you're, I mean, we hear a lot about sectarian violence. I mean, is that, can you only have certain trucks operating in certain areas? Are they a target? I never hear about the food distribution trucks getting bombed. I'm just wondering what that's all about. The other thing is, you talked about the, I think it was sort of 100, at least 100 Kuwaiti businesses operating in southern Iraq. And one of the sort of common characterizations is that it's Iranian businesses that have sort of taken and flourished in southern Iraq. So is that common understanding? I've never been to southern Iraq. Is that sort of an exaggeration? In fact, there's a distinctive Kuwaiti face there that we just never hear about.
Yeah.
Why don't we ever hear about if there's so much Kuwaiti activity?
Yeah. Thanks. Look, on the first point on violence, I am not an Iraq expert. I mean, I've been there twice. I've been involved in some of the economic issues. There's no doubt in my mind that there's a serious security challenge in Iraq. But in the same breath, you have to say it doesn't completely asphyxiate the economy. There's a fair amount of economic activity. So we could have spent 20 or 30 minutes just on economic data. But, for example, oil production is high. It's not at peak. But 2.1 million barrels a day, and I think peak was 2.4. So that's a very high degree of oil production. And it shows you've got engineers, you've got technicians, you've got transportation, you're putting in maintenance, you're doing CapEx. I mean, it shows a lot of things are happening in order to maintain that high degree of oil production, despite a challenging environment. So there is all sorts of economic activity underway, but it is burdened by violence. And I cannot wait or fully assess that myself. But we can say that violence does not asphyxiate normal economic activity. On your second point on Iran versus Kuwait, or to what extent is Iran there, we know that there's a lot of Iranian movement, perfectly legitimate commerce, in addition to probably some things that aren't perfectly legitimate. We know there's Iranian involvement in the Iraqi economy. I couldn't give you a number on that, but of course I'm looking at it from a U.S. perspective where we have our trade sanctions vis-a-vis Iran, so we're not advocating U.S. companies use Iran as a economic platform for activity in Iraq, but we are saying look at Kuwait, look at UAE, look at Amman, look at Istanbul. Yeah, I think a lot of what goes on in southern Iraq does have a Kuwait face to it, does have a brand name or parentage that Iraqis know is a Kuwait undertaking, and they're comfortable with that. And it's no different than a lot of locales in Europe or Central America where there's a lot of cross-border business, and there has been for decades. Thanks.
Mr. Undersecretary, thank you very much. My name is Soheib El-Barzanji. I'm the Iraq Program Officer at the Center for International Private Enterprise. We do a lot of work in Iraq, especially with associations and chambers of commerce. I have two quick questions. Mm-hmm. With our emphasis on investment going to Kurdistan, this has propelled the Kurdish regional government to go ahead and pass laws and legislations conducive to foreign investment, property rights, and so on. And some of these laws are contrary to what the national Iraqi interest is, or go contrary to what the National Assembly wants to do. And this is further emboldening the Kurds to sort of deassociate themselves from the Iraq as a nation, and giving them more sort of economic stability so ultimately they can disassociate themselves from the country if need be. Doesn't that run contrary to our national interest?
That's a great question, and we have to be very sensitive that that's not the path we go down. I think we can say this. We can support an approach that involves regionalism and differentiation but does not endorse separatism. So I think we're capable of making that distinction, which is to say, look, Iraq itself is a federal system. Different provinces have their own government, and they'll have their own regulations, and they'll be more appealing or less appealing for business operations, depending on their resource endowment, their location, then their policy framework. And so it makes sense for U.S. businesses to respond in kind to that. But what that doesn't mean is that we endorse this as a political phenomenon, that we want to see an Iraqi Kurdistan operate independently or inconsistent with the Iraqi constitution. So I think we're very sensitive to that point. And what we would say is, please look at Iraqi Kurdistan, and we think that's a good platform for business activity. But there are other parts of Iraq as well where the security situation is well in hand. Or we can look offshore for activity and use that as a way to go in. We talked about a southern strategy as well as a northern strategy. So we're not making a political statement. We are simply saying, let's respect the market. And my response to friends in Baghdad would be, look, if you see the Kurdistan region doing something that you think is pro-economic growth and that, in a sense, gives them a sort of advantage in competing for international business activity, please encourage the other provinces to do it as well. Let's have this be a positive competition for international activity. Let's not punish or censor somebody who's successful in attracting international business activity.
Okay.
Thanks. Met your site fellow in Erbil, by the way, too.
Yeah. And my next quick question is, what bothers me is also the emphasis on state-owned enterprises and the commercialization of state-owned enterprises. All the people we work with always indicate that these are obsolete enterprises, that even if they were to be commercialized, they will not be competitive. They're 30 years behind the curve, and if they were to be commercialized, they won't be even able to compete in their local market, of course not in the regional market as well. And it's always a question of the private sector does not really attach any importance to commercializing this. It's only the Iraqi government that's pushing for this. Wouldn't it make more sense? It certainly makes more sense to the Iraqis that this money be spent in, for example, encouraging entrepreneurship or some other way of economic reform rather than putting this inordinate amount of emphasis on the state-owned enterprises. Thank you.
Well, yeah, let me just comment about SOEs in my view. And there's a range of views on this in the U.S., and there's a range of views on this in Baghdad as well. We use the word commercialize because it's a broad term. Some people use a slightly different word, privatize, which suggests that in a relatively short order, every one of these has to be put on some kind of market footing. I personally don't think that's realistic. So I chose a broader term that says, look, regardless of where you want to eventually be with these companies, and I think we want them at some point to have to operate according to market principles, but regardless of what your ultimate goal is, what we and there's going to be, that's a political call, there's going to be a range of views on that. What we can all say, I think, at least as a near-term goal, commercialize means get as close to those market principles as you can, have published accounts, audited books, public statements about what you're doing, market price your inputs, market price your outputs. I mean, move down that path so that you're respecting market principles. And you're right, not everybody's going to have an easy time making it, but some people will. Some people will, maybe their production facility is antiquated, as you suggest, but the brand is still a good brand, or the distribution system is a good distribution system, or the technology is okay. So what they need is an outside investor to come in and say, look, we'll bring in some folks. I was talking with a person yesterday who said, you know, their energy sector is reasonably good, then what's underdeveloped are some of the downstream production activities that take place out of an oil sector, ethylene production, ammonia production, and so forth, that could easily be world-class, but as you point out today, is not. What they need is investment, but they've got petroleum engineers, they've got technicians, they've got a lot of elements of that, but they do need to be recapitalized. So we need to look for ways of who's going to come in with what kind of funds and get that ammonia processing plant going to world norms. So there's it's a mosaic. There's some things that will probably do very well and other parts that are going to need to be reformed. For the sake of this discussion, we said commercialization is probably as apt a word as fits the moment to describe this much more complicated process.
And if I could offer, we have a press release on the table about the state-owned enterprises, and what the press release is arguing is that when you're thinking about revitalizing these state-owned enterprises, you not only need to think about how they fit in the value chain from a commercial perspective, you also need to think about who you're empowering by revitalizing those state-owned enterprises. Are you empowering those that seek to perpetuate the conflict? Are you empowering those that will actually fuel the militia? So you need to inject conflict analysis when you're dealing in a conflict cycle. That needs to almost be first and foremost in, I think, USIP's opinion behind any kind of commercial perspective. Mr. Tucker.
Bill Tucker, you mentioned that the oil and gas legislation is moving. I understood that the administration had drafted some legislation and submitted to the parliament. And do you know when that's going to be passed? Is there some kind of timetable?
I think it either gone further than that or gone to the Council of Ministers, and I think it had actually passed, but not the implementing regs. Sean, do you have?
It's through the Council of Ministers. It needs to still go through the parliament. Okay. The government of Iraq has set an internal deadline of May 31st to actually pass the legislation, and somewhat differently than the investment law. The investment law they passed and then started working on the implementing regulations. Here they claim to be further along and have implementing regulations that are ready to follow quickly thereafter. So there's some good hope that progress will accelerate.
Thanks.
Thanks,
Bill.
Sir.
Thanks very much. I appreciate the speech. I'd commend to you the work of, there's a small businessman and journalist named Michael Totten who's currently in Herbal, and he has almost identical pictures of things like the Dream City and the mall and so forth.
Yeah.
But the reason I come up here to mention that fellow is that he's also a small businessman that's American. I don't see a central point to make it easy for individual small businessmen or investors to either go Northern Strategy or go into Iraq as a whole. Can you point me where we've been working on that?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, with one very important exception, and it's kind of an impressive exception, what we're seeing overwhelmingly in terms of U.S. business activity in Iraq, it's folks who already have some degree of activity in the region. And so it's easier to view Iraq as an ancillary market. It's much less likely to have somebody wake up one day in the U.S. and say, you know, I'm not really overseas, I'm not really in the region, but I need to find a way to get to Iraq. So almost everybody we're working with is somebody who's already got some activity. So if you're Procter & Gamble distributor in Western Turkey, it's a much easier discussion to say, look, let's put some extra trucks on the route. Let's work out financing and payments. Let's work out the border issues, and let's get these great Procter & Gamble products into the Kurdistan region.
Much
and
easier
let's,
to work with one organization than a bunch of little ones.
Yeah. The one exception, which is important to note, and we ran into this time and time again, is there is a substantial pool of very impressive Iraqi Americans who do wake up in the morning and say, you know what, I really got to get back to Iraq and I got to get something going. And it's the talent base is just terrific. I mean, and the you know, time and time again, you're running into a person. Then you mentioned Dream City. There's also this American city outside of Erbil where the Iraqi American construction group is building this housing development, and it's $120 million project, and it's like any suburban housing development you might find in the United States. And this guy was an engineer for the Fairfax Department of Roads and Highways, and he said, guess what our engineering specs are here in our housing development? Fairfax Roads and Highways. So he said, that's all I know. And he said, it seems to work pretty well in Fairfax County. So you might see the grading look very familiar and the specs and the spacing look very familiar. And I said, yeah, it sure kind of looks like Fairfax. So you got this incredible pool of people who, you know, they're real heroes. They're typically somebody's doing something very interesting here, a little family business. But he says, you know, my cousins are back there and we can get this thing going. And
or even I've seen groups of returning veterans. If you look at any of the mill blogs, you see lots and lots of people doing speculation on dinars because that's the only way they can think of to invest.
Yeah.
But they obviously have skin in the fight somewhere, so they would like to invest somewhere.
So there are things bubbling along. Those are really the two pools I think I would encourage people to look at. I honestly would, with maybe there's an exception, but at the typical U.S. SME that doesn't have an international footprint, I'd say start in Canada. Mm-hmm. Get that business going. Let's talk about Iraq after you get Canada going.
Thanks.
And sir, if I could note, in the reconstruction contracts, the $18 billion for reconstruction funding, there were very rigid subcontracting requirements. And for many of the contractors, actually just went to a talk this morning by Washington Group International, where 25% of their subcontracts went to U.S. businesses, most of which were small businesses. So in that regard, small business did have an opportunity to participate, not necessarily on the ground, but via the larger general contractors.
Thanks.
Sir. Mr. Tucker, can you help him, sir? Thank you.
Thanks. Hi. Welcome. Salesman in chief. My name is Faribos Frank Fouladi. I run a company called Procurement USA Inc. in Gaithersburg, Maryland. We try to export life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness via economical means. I'm also a member of Montgomery County Chamber of Commerce. I was wondering that how about bringing the Iraqi businesses to connect with American businesses in a micro level. You know, small business in Montgomery County with a small business there and connecting to each other so people see a different view of what is in Iraq. By the way, I am a Muslim, Persian native, and American citizen.
That's great. Look, I love what you're saying because the more that we can help folks in Iraq develop sort of a merchant consciousness in the business community, the better off we're all going to be. And there is a natural entrepreneurial spirit you see in the business community, but because, you know, this is a group that really been battered by Saddam for decades. And, you know, there's not a banking system, there's not access to capital, there's not trained management. They've got all these constraints of several decades of the legacy problems.
I'm working to about 7 years.
So you know this. But by the same token, you go down the street, and they're all mom-and-pop shops, but there's a natural merchant orientation. And whatever we can do to foster that and help these smallest shops become the manufacturers, the processors, the assemblers, the distributors, and really start soaking up unemployment and moving that whole economy ahead, we're going to be better off. And there's an enormous amount of discussion underway as to how do you do that. I think over the long run, what we're going to look at is the same way other societies do it, which is business training. It can be vocational. It can be business schools. But we've got to develop a educational system in Iraq that allows business to be more successful. And that's going to be the best way of nurturing that process there's already business schools and similar type activities underway. It's just going to be a while to get that process going. Think of East Germany after the transition. So you have West Germany, an enormously successful economy, one of the strongest in the world. You have East Germany under decades of totalitarian rule. And it's not just flipping a light switch saying, okay, you're politically free now, because there's a series of educational and social patterns that have to be adjusted to modern times. And so I think it's just going to be a while before Iraq is fully there. That's why I think that offshore Iraqis are going to be so important to coming back in and helping that business environment.
So you think Chamber of Commerce to Chamber of Commerce is not a good idea?
Well, I'm all for it. The point is, that's a very expensive program. I don't know exactly what you're suggesting. But to say we're going to get the Montgomery County Chamber of Commerce to link up with Iraq counterparts, that's great. And are they going to go there for a month or 6 months or do what kind of training and what's supposed to happen? Who's going to write? It's a very expensive proposition. Over the long run, the best way to do this is going to be with indigenous training, so that we have Iraqi accountants, we have people trained in business management and financial management and so forth, and we just don't have a lot of that now. But whatever we can do to foster P2P programs, I certainly support. Thanks.
Good afternoon. Francis Johnson, Strategic Planning Initiatives. Two topics. One, the informal sector in Iraq, and the other is news from Iraq to, say, the U.S. on this business surge, let's call it. On the informal sector, what does our Commerce Department contingent know or have capability of knowing as to how the informal sector operates? Maybe 60% of Iraqis are in the formal sector, and they can use smuggling, they can use barter, they can use, you do it for me and I'll scratch your back type of thing.
Right.
But they have trouble getting into the credit economy if they don't document, if they can't document what they own and therefore draw credit from Iraqis or elsewhere. The other is what we all would wish, that on the media we would see some of this, what are the Iraqis doing for themselves? Obviously, when they're building their country the way you're telling us now, that's what they are doing, same as we did in our colonial and revolutionary period. We know that in the media, if it bleeds, it leads, and that's what gets published.
Yeah.
But what avenues have you seen that are working that get some of this news back to us here, so we have a vignette here or a vignette there that the Iraqis are actually building their country?
Yeah. Thank you for both those questions. Look, I'll tell you what we did on the informal sector. I'm also share your concern that I think if you grew up in a Saddam Hussein kind of economy, you're not used to cooperating with the government. You don't view it as a plus. You're skeptical about how it might help you, and I think that's a strong push to people to stay in that informal sector. Part of the recommendations in our slideshow to the government of Iraq was, please think through the cost and benefit of your tax system, and please think through the cost and benefit of your tariff system. Because Iraq's economy is oil-based, and there can be other industry, and there's an agriculture sector, there's other things going on. But overwhelmingly, for the near term, it's going to be oil-based. Use that as a blessing. You don't get necessarily a lot of revenue or benefit out of income tax. You don't necessarily need that, or from tariffs. But what both those do is provide scope for corruption or manipulation, and they push people toward the informal sector. So somewhere over 93% of total Iraq government revenue came from oil sales. Everything else, every other tax, tariff, duty, fee, the entire government came from the other 7%. So when you think about it, you say, look, get oil production up a little bit and do away with everything else. You just don't need it. And it may be the perfect world. Maybe you can't get there this week, but think about that as a model. So because that informal sector won't help you the way if these people formally into the sector will, so we agree with you on that. I don't know what to do on your second point on the news side. I mean, I think that the violence in Iraq is graphic. It's part of reality. So I'm not here to deny it, but I'm just here to say there's more than that that's going on. There's good news in the picture as well, and we just need to be mindful of that. And, you know, every time you get to, I've only been there twice, but every time you talk to these people, they have exactly the approach you articulated. which is this is their life. This is their home. This is their family. This is where their parents came from. And they've got to find a way to make it work. And they don't have a lot of means, and they've been battered and abused by Saddam Hussein for decades. But this is their world, and they're trying to do what they can to improve it. And, in fact, in the Kurdistan region, it's actually quite poignant because that group was singled out for a very special abuse by Saddam Hussein. So there's enormous reservoir of goodwill towards the United States in that region. And every single person you talk to has one of these terrible stories about a family member or a neighbor or somebody who was kidnapped and never found again or killed or some terrible occurrence in their immediate family or neighborhood by Saddam Hussein, and how it was American help that put an end to it. And they are very proud of what they're starting to build. And from our standards, in just a pure statistical terms, you'd say, well, look, it isn't much. But for them, it is their life, it is their country, and they have a right to be proud of what they're building. So it is quite a poignant set of discussions you could have. Thank you for the comment.
My name is Rafaeli. I'm with the Middle East Media Research Institute. I agree with the Secretary that there is some good news coming from Iraq. One of it is the rate of exchange of the dinar vis-a-vis the dollar. As of yesterday, the Central Bank of Iraq announced that the rate of exchange has now is 1,300 dinar per dollar, which is an appreciation of 15% in the last 3 months.
But that's good. So it's strengthening. That's good. By the way, Iraqi sovereign bonds, which are out in the market, if you want an indication of reasonably stable macroeconomic situation, I'll bet if we asked everybody here to write down a number on a piece of paper, unless you're following this stuff, you'd get it wrong. Because what percent interest rates do Iraqi government bonds pay?
12-14%.
9%. Saying the risk premium isn't that huge. No. So, they've got a lot of oil money. I mean, the bonds aren't an outrageous risk. So that's an interesting figure.
Mr. Secretary, you identified three goals that you have put before the Iraqi government. I was wondering why the banking system was not mentioned specifically as one of the goals. And I just want to mention my own personal experience. Yeah. We have an office in Baghdad.
Yeah.
And I have a problem transferring money to Baghdad every month. We go to Jordan. Yeah. Today we send money through Western Union. They charge 8.5% commission for the transfer of money. Yeah. So I think this is one of the, to start economic activity and repatriation of capital from Jordan and Syria, other parts of the diaspora to Iraq, you have to have a viable banking system, which now does not exist.
Yeah, thank you. Could you go back to, I think it's the third or fourth slide we're talking about. Just to make sure I don't confuse people, we talked about three goals for this year, which is investment law, hydrocarbon law, and marquee investment. And then we talked about economic priorities. And just to make sure you know that I didn't ignore, but we said, look, all of these we view as longer-term incremental. These are important, but I don't see any of them, these getting quote-unquote fixed this year. But to come up with a system to start to fix it, fix some of it, to start chipping away, I think is a worthy undertaking. What we would hope are fixed this year are those three points that I left with investment law, hydrocarbon law, marquee investment, that those all really need to get done this calendar year. So banking is one of the key priorities we identified. I don't think we're going to fix it all this year.
My name is Hamam Irwaisi. I am coming from Colorado. I just want to give you some information. I just come back from northern Iraq, Kurdish region, March 6th. I stayed over there 6 weeks. My origin is a Kurd from northern Iraq. There is a peace over there and very good place to invest. Just doing a little advertising, then I have a question for you. My company's name is Alliance Investment Group. I like to work with anybody who wants to do work over there. The Kurd, by the way, is not planning to separate from Iraq maybe for another 100 years or more. The reason I can give you the exact reason, the Kurd in Iraq feel very, very rich. They don't want to join the Kurd in Turkey or Iran or other places. That's true, So they don't have any plan to separate. And the business opportunity is everywhere. I am trying to build a farming co-op, coming to begging our government to give me some money. to do it, and that's why I'm here in Washington. And then another question for gentleman here. I have a group in Texas. We want to build them a refinery for Kurdish region and doing oil and gas exploration. We don't get any help from our government here in U.S. Plus, we try to sell them like power generator. It doesn't work out. So we need some help on the ground. I was just coming back 6 weeks ago. We need some help from our government with the Kurdish government.
Hamad, I'll just jump in on this because about every day, not necessarily Iraq-related, because, you know, as Undersecretary, it's a global responsibility. So we do a lot of China work, a lot of India work, Western Hemisphere, General Mideast, and so forth. About every single day, I'll have somebody who approaches me in good faith, a good guy, good woman, and says, I've got a business plan. I want to do something in country X, sometimes a country of origin or where they have some special connectivity. It's a good plan, good model, good idea. All I need is money. How much do you have on you? And I say, Hamad, I say to you every single day, look, I'm all for your plan. I'm all for your plan.
Thank you.
If I had the money to give out, I wouldn't be in this job. I'd be out there and doing private equity myself.
Sure.
Right? I can find the deals if I got the money. If you say you got the deal, all you need is the money. Well, there's this world is awash in liquidity. So if you got a good deal, you'll find them. There's money going into the Kurdistan region.
Well, I'm saying both ways. I want grant from my government,
yeah.
And I want the help from my government,
yeah,
to make the thing going on the ground.
Right.
Like we are not asking for money to build a refinery,
right,
or doing exploration.
Right.
Just need some help from the State Department with their State Department. The
right.
Kurdish government is, you know, starter. They don't have too much experience,
yeah,
to do the work, really.
Yeah.
They need a lot of the training themselves. Like, for example, I go to the minister, and it is unique in the world. I call the minister at 8 o'clock, and he will give me appointment at 8:30. There is nothing existing in the world like this. But then when you go over there, it will take 3 hours before you can say your word, because somebody will drop by and say, Kakflan, I have this thing for you.
Yeah.
It just doesn't, the work doesn't go. I spent 6 weeks over there. I didn't accomplish anything.
Yeah.
Tell you the
yeah.
truth,
but
our government need to train them,
yeah,
or have their ear to the businesses in America,
yeah,
to do some businesses with America.
Hamad, we might not solve your particular problems in the course of this discussion.
Okay.
But if you talk with Sean, I'll ask him to follow up with you. But
appreciate
let me say this.
That.
But let me say this: there are, I think the numbers we got in connection with the trip was there are just over 300 foreign businesses operating in the Kurdistan region now. So we need to look into your questions and problems, see what went wrong. And my request to you, sir, is please you look into what you might be doing. Why aren't you one of those 300? So there's a lot of business activity taking place there. Maybe there's problems on the U.S. government side, maybe on the Kurdistan regional government side, but maybe it's with your business model, your approach. So we need to be open-minded to all this, and let's see if we can find a way ahead.
Sure.
Good.
Thank you.
Well, sir, thank you. My name is John Rogers, and I work for the Defense Department. We're using economic models to predict job losses in state-owned enterprises.
Yeah.
And with respect to the emphasis on the security and sectarian violence problem, so I just wanted to get your comments on how you would approach the issue of
sure.
labor redundancies.
I think that's a vital concern. Again, when we talked before about, well, why are you saying commercialized? If these aren't long-term viable, why not just privatize? Well, because there's other priorities at play as well. Because we're not in the business of going into an environment as tumultuous as Iraq and firing people. That just is not helpful long-term interest. I think what you want to do is stabilize these SOEs, do what help you can with what input you can. As the general situation improves, as the economy improves, then I think we'll have more latitude to move toward market rationalization. But I don't think that would be my near-term priority. My near-term priority would be to say what is the biggest bang for buck I can get out of some minor inputs in capital or technology or management to get these places running, to keep them going, even if it is sort of 1950s level. But for the near term, maybe I'll take that. And then let's see what we can do to upgrade that.
Okay.
So I agree with those priorities.
Thanks.
Yep.
Mr. Crum.
Hi, I'm Jim Crum, the director of the Project and Contracting Office for Iraq Reconstruction back here in Washington. And we've built over 2,800 projects in country, which is another story that's difficult to get out in the media. But my question is build a little bit more on your observations on Kurdistan, which I think is getting better documented about its economic growth. If we were to put Kurdistan say, on a scale of 1 to 10, that it's at step 10 of its path towards economic growth, can you compare your observations with the southern portion and the central portion of Iraq? Just very roughly, is where they are in the journey, given their obstacles.
It's hard for me. That's a great question. It's hard for me, Jim, to do that because I've not really spent any time. I've spent time in Baghdad and in Erbil, and that's it. So I can't say, here's what I see in Basra, and here's what I see in Anbar. I just don't have that capabilities. Maybe others do. But my point was simply, there are other places like Kurdistan. And if your company has international capabilities or, say, capabilities in developed markets, if you can operate outside an OECD framework where it can be an uneven operating environment, you'll do fine in the Kurdistan region. And my guess is the other parts of Iraq as well. So it's not too different from other places in this hemisphere that just are uneven. So, you know, banking practices might be uneven, but there are banks. Electricity supply might not be 24/7, but there's electricity supply. And there's a consuming middle class, although a middle class person might have 10% disposable income as one in the United States. I mean, so you have the attributes of a successful economy there. And if you can operate in the third world, you can operate in the Kurdistan region effectively. And there's other parts of Iraq you can as well. And what I like about the gateway strategy, it's the low-hanging fruit argument. Start with a place where you don't have a security situation per se. Start your operations, start your sales, your distribution, get through local advertising, local regulations, local hiring. You know, you'll develop market familiarity and then build that out. So you don't need the whole country to be perfect. You need part of the country to be functional, and you can start building something out. So that was our only point to the business community.
My name is Miramo, and I just was curious as to, because you say there doesn't seem to be too much problem in Kurdistan, what about the PKK? Is that giving anyone any problem there, or is that a worry? Or
What I said was I thought the security situation was well in hand in Kurdistan, which is not to say it's perfect, not to say that's where you want to move and raise your family, but it's to say if you're looking just for a business operating environment, I think you'd be pretty comfortable in the Kurdistan region. So I think there are other issues and challenges about Kurdistan going forward. I mean, they've had self-government in some form or fashion for about 10 years. They've had evolutionary democracy underway, but I think there are challenges in the Kurdistan region as well. What I'm saying is, for normal business activity, I think you can undertake that effectively in the Kurdistan region.
And is there PKK infiltration, or is there a problem?
I honestly couldn't speak to.
I can tell you.
Okay, but I'm going to ask USIP to have another seminar, Hamad, and you can have that seminar on PKK infiltration.
No problem with the PKK.
Well, there you go. Okay. No need for that extra seminar there. Okay, good.
Hi, I'm Hank Richmond. You mentioned your department's involvement earlier in the PRTs, and could you? We're getting ready to surge additional PRTs to Iraq. Could you comment on how your department is preparing your participants to be on members of the PRT?
Sure.
And to what extent are you synchronizing your department's efforts with those of other U.S. government agencies?
Sure. Well, the PRTs are run through the state system and with strong DOD participation, and there can be anywhere of a half dozen different U.S. government agencies. In a sense, that's not different from management point of view than an embassy operations, where you might have 20 different U.S. government elements in that embassy operations, and there'll be overlapping jurisdiction. So civil aviation, there might be an FAA rep, but there'll also be a state econ officer, but there might also be a very strong input from the Air Force attaché, and that's why you have a country team mechanism. So I'm comfortable with the PRT management. And by the way, as you know, some of the PRTs, the Erbil one is run by Korean, National Korean Ambassador. So we have coalition partners in the PRTs and the IRTs as well. So we think it fits pretty well together. I mean, some are going to be more effective than others. But what I saw in the Kurdistan region, it was mood was good, impact was good, they had a good role. Again, they've got the security situation in hand, so you can really do your core mission of how do we help the economy build out, how do we foster economic growth in that kind of environment. Others are going to have a tougher time.
Thanks. Thank you. Thank you. My name is Ahmed Barzani. I'm from Voice of America Kurdish Service.
Mm-hmm.
There will be a referendum in Kirkuk in November.
Yeah.
So how do you think that will affect the situation in Kurdistan region?
If people have not been following with this, Kirkuk is scheduled to have a referendum in November as to whether or not it should be administered by the Kurdistan regional government or remain an autonomous province. I don't have a prediction on that. It's for the voters there to decide, and I think we're going to be prepared to support or work with whoever wins. But, the good news in this is you've got these kind of very important local decisions being made on a peaceful, democratic basis.
All right. Thank you.
How are you doing on time, sir?
Maybe this should be our last question.
Okay.
I'm
Howie Lind. I work for Jim Crum at the Iraq
Great.
Project and Contracting Office. Work Capitol Hill issues, among other things. But we've heard today, I'm not sure, it might just be today, that it's coming out of the U.S. House of Representatives, that they're considering a bill that would prohibit U.S. investment in Iraq's oil infrastructure until the hydrocarbon law is passed in Iraq. It seems kind of drastic. Good thing. Bad. Of course, we want the hydrocarbon bill passed, but, I mean, what's that going to do to the economy?
I hadn't heard that, so it's hard for me to comment on the legislation. Let me just say this. U.S. businesses operate around the world in every conceivable type of political environment, with every kind of guarantee or lack thereof, protection lack thereof, treaty arrangement lack thereof, free trade agreement lack thereof. Every single market in which we operate has some degree of difference to it, the risk profile, investment profile, and so forth. And our view is that's okay as long as you're pricing it correctly and you know what you're getting into. But it's not our job to say, don't invest in Nicaragua because we think there's a weaker investment regime than Honduras. We say it's all right. As long as you understand that there's less investment protection in Nicaragua, there's never been a case of expropriation since democracy returned to Nicaragua. There's never been unfair treatment, but there is a weaker investment regime. So it's not for us to tell people what they shouldn't do or what they must do, and I don't think it'd be wise on a legal basis to make that point, but say just be aware of what environment you're going into, what protections they have, what the U.S. government responsibility is, and act accordingly. So, an informed customer is the best way to do business.
Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, sir. It's been very, very insightful.
Thank you. Thanks, everybody.